Hello and welcome to Dog Talk with me, your host, Nick Benger, the ultimate podcast to help you take the next step in your dog training journey by learning from the best experts from around the world. Hello, welcome to the show. Get in shape Tember has started. We're all in a lot of pain. And if you don't even know what that is, and you missed the episode, basically, me, John McGuigan, Taz Nichols, and Steve Goodall are competing to run the furthest accumulated distance in September. We're also not allowed caffeine, although, to be honest, that isn't bothering me too much because I'm only an occasional tea drinker, but I think the other guys are struggling with that. We're doing this all for charity, so if you want to follow the progress, the banter, all that kind of stuff, then you can join us in the Facebook group, which is Get In Shape Tember. There's also a charity page there, so if you have the ability to donate, obviously that would be hugely appreciated. And also, I have to tease you a little bit. In October, we're going to be offering probably the biggest thing I've ever done. It's really crazy. A huge amount of work has gone into it. I can't tell you what it is yet, and by its nature, it's going to be super exclusive. I can't really say why without giving it away, but you know, if all I can say is stay tuned because you're not going to want to miss out on this. Today I'm talking to Denise Fenzi. Denise is the founder of the Fenzi Dog Sports Academy. She's competed in a wide range of sports and is best known for her flashy and precise obedience work. She's an international speaker and the author of several books on dog training, so I know you're going to enjoy this one. Let's just get into it. Hey, Denise, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
It's really cool to have you on, and I know you were, well, we're both eager to talk about this idea of the connection between dog sports and pet dog training, because I know that you're more in the sports world, I'm more in the pet dog training world, so let's see where we go. Actually, I'll let you start, Denise, because I know you had some really cool ideas, but I'm so eager to get there. I've got so many questions.
Before we started, I was all set to go running, and Nick is like, stop. Like, I guarantee you, I can do this as many times as you want to do. This is not a challenge. Yeah. So what we were talking about before we started, in the old days, and I'm old, so I know about the old days. In the old days, let's say 30, 40 years ago, the way dogs got trained is you went to a local dog club. And this is in the United States. I don't know what happened in the rest of the world. So, and there were lots of them. You know, I would say every 10 or 15 miles in a populated area, you would have a dog club, and maybe they rented space from a local fairgrounds or a park. You know, also liability issues were lower, so you could actually rent spaces with dogs. And so you would go there, and training was a little rough, you know, so you'd drag your dog in a circle for 6 weeks. And at the end of 6 weeks, maybe you were looking to the left and you noticed over there, these dogs were doing fancy things. They were going over jumps. They were fetching things. And maybe if you were a dog person in your heart, you didn't know that yet, but you're going to find out. So you're looking over there at these people and you're saying, what are those dogs doing? And someone says, well, those dogs are preparing for dog shows. And so maybe you came back for a second round of classes. And next thing you know, 6 months down the road, you go to your first dog show and you become a dog person. And then, so you train your dog and you love it and you join the club. And from there, what we had was a lot of volunteers. And also, again, keep in mind, 40 years ago, a lot of women did not work. And so many of these classes were taught by volunteer women who had the freedom. They had the free time. The kids had left the house and they would teach these classes. The prices were incredibly reasonable. And they became pet dog trainers really by accident. They would teach the beginning classes. And it's also worth pointing out that in those days, obedience classes were sit down, come, stay, heel. They were the basics. We really didn't talk about go to mat or we just addressed it differently. It was very much about teaching these basic skills. And so you developed this situation where the dog sports community actually set the direction of pet dog training. And when it looked good, then the pet dog training looked good. And when it didn't look good, then the pet dog training reflected that in the area. And I actually find this fascinating because that has not really changed. There's still a huge amount of influence that flows down from the sport bag world. Now, what has changed is now there's a reverse flow. So now I'm also seeing the best of the, let's say, animal training in general, the whole thing, the best of the behavior world, both coming out of the academic side and just people who are very interested. I'm starting to see their best practices flow up to the sport dog trainers who are realizing, oh, you break things down, maybe you use a clicker or a marker. There's things they could take from that community. And so now there's a much more interesting flow back and forth, which having been on both sides of it and still am on both sides, I find very interesting to watch.
Yeah, I find this idea really interesting as well. And I think it's always good that there's kind of a flow of information. And I do think there's both communities probably have more to learn from each other as well. And that doesn't even, that's not even restricted to dogs as well, because like you said, you know, when you start talking to people that are training different animals, there's even more stuff to learn there. But I mean, I've not been in it as long as you, you know, you've probably seen more than I have, but even in the short time I've been in it, there seems to have been a shift in the pet dog world from more of those kind of traditional classes that you were describing, walking in circles and stuff, to what people might call life skills, you know, like teaching settles and more of an emphasis on socialization, which I know is a hot topic for you as well. And, you know, like there's more of an emphasis on what the pet dog is actually going to be doing, you know, stops and stuff, as opposed to teaching obedience exercises because that's what we've always done kind of thing.
Yeah, there is no question in my mind that the quality of pet dog training has skyrocketed, because no owner ever has said the most useful thing I learned in dog training class was a standstay. Honest to God. I mean, one more time, let's talk about when you need a standstay or a finish from front to side, you know? And even the simple thing like heeling, the old heeling was by your side, sit at every curb. It was very formal and really dull. Now we talk about loose leash walking, which is much more interesting for the dog, much more relaxed for the human, much less military and controlled. There's no question that the pet dog, the new direction is so much better, because that's what people want. Pet people will be very happy with their dog if it comes when it's called, it does not pull on a leash, it doesn't jump on your guest, it doesn't bark day and night. If you have that, most people can make do. That's it. And throw in a settle on a mat, and my God, you have the best trained dog in the neighborhood. That's really what people want. And I think we've done a really good job at changing the quality of the best classes. Now, you know, tradition is strong. And so there's still too many classes that teach dogs to walk in circles for an hour, which is just about the most miserable and dull experience for a dog or for a person. But I do see that change coming. And I'm really excited about that approach, because I think it makes the pet dog trainer a much richer experience. And I personally believe that this is about the best time to become a pet dog trainer ever. And I started titling dogs 40 years ago, so I know the difference. Now you can go into people's homes and really work with the individual. What does that person want? What does that dog need? How can everybody get their needs met? This is a completely new way of thinking. In the old days, nobody asked what the dog wanted. Nobody cared what the dog wanted. And, you know, in full disclosure, I could have cared less either. I just wanted my way. And now we look at the community. The owner has some rights. The dog should not be running their household because it exists. That's like a toddler out of control. The dog has rights. It's a sentient being and it deserves respect. Society has rights. Your neighbor has a right not to listen to your dog bark 16 hours a day. And I think this direction of travel from it's all about the human, then I have to say, and you know, I am more comfortable criticizing within my community than outside. So I'm going to criticize within my community. I have noticed that within my community, maybe there's a little too much emphasis on the well-being of the dog at the expense of everybody else. And that is not, in my opinion, even remotely acceptable. People have rights too. And now I think the direction of travel that I would love to see us moving towards is balance. So what I say, happy dog, happy handler, happy society. Everyone might have to give a little. The dog may not get its way. Yes, I put you on a leash. I know you want to be off leash. Sometimes you don't get your way. People have to give a little. Society has to give a little. We all give a little. And hopefully that makes for a better situation for all. And then, of course, the dog trainer is a piece of that picture as well. So I have seen in some situations where it almost feels like the trainer and the handler against the dog. That would be a traditional model of training. I have seen the trainer and the dog against the owner. That would be the extreme positive reinforcement situation. And those are both incorrect and wrong, in my opinion. The correct situation is the balance of all the interests. And I do think this is the time when we can start heading in that direction. I think we have the skills and the range to think that way.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of dog trainers that find it really easy to have empathy for the dog and struggle to have empathy for the owners that are the ones struggling with their dog's behavior. And I think that for me, I came from, you know, when I started getting interested in dog training, it was through necessity because I had the dog that was driving me up the wall. So I can kind of put myself in that position and understand what it feels like when your dog is doing all of these things that are, you know, at the end of the day, they're annoying, you know, and they do make you angry. They make you frustrated. They make you upset, you know, when you think your dog's going to hurt another dog or a person or get themselves killed or something like that. So I think that definitely I can see what you mean about that. You kind of have to have empathy for the people as well. I was really interested, because I'm not involved in the dog sports world, about that flow backwards, you know, from the pet dog training stuff to the dog sports and what kind of stuff you've seen change.
Well, I remember my mom was in dog sports before me. I was born into a family. And I remember talking to my mom about this idea of waiting until a dog did something and then saying it, naming it. And I thought that was the most bizarre, stupid thing I had ever heard. And that's pretty funny because now how do I train dogs, right? So I wait till something's about to happen and I name it. So somehow that information was starting to come to me, but I didn't need it yet because really, you know, we have an expression, necessity is the mother of invention. And there's an incredible amount of truth to that. So if you are struggling with a problem and a pet dog trainer who happens to have skills of, let's say, breaking things down, but no competition skills, can look at your situation and say, well, have you tried doing it in smaller increments? So that's a nice, I think that's very much come from the behavior world, the idea of splitting behaviors into small bits and training the bits and then throwing them all together. So if somebody comes to me and says, instead of holding your dog by the collar, throwing a toy over a jump, and then running with your dog, pointing at the jump, pointing at the object, pointing at the jump, and then hoping the dog sort of kind of, you know, comes back to you, why don't you teach the dog to go over a jump? Teach the dog to stay. Teach the dog to pick up an object. Teach the dog to come to front. There's, I could break that into 20 pieces. Why don't you try that and then string it all together? And that way of thinking comes from the newer, more behavior slash pet world. I don't know if pet world is the right world, but the pet world is also heavily influenced from the behavior world, not just the sport world. There's two directions there. That comes from either behavior or pet to the dog sports world. That was not something the dog sports people thought up.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I guess it's kind of, you know, it kind of, I guess Karen Pryor's book really popularized that, right? Don't shoot
Absolutely.
The dog. You know, really
Absolutely.
Popularized, I guess you could say behaviorism, right? Like it really popularized that model of looking at behavior and then splitting it and doing all that kind of stuff. And
yes, and the other direction is modern parenting. So if you look at modern parenting, dog training almost always lags human parenting, right? So I don't hit my children. That is a choice. My parents hit me. So it wasn't, don't get this wrong. I wasn't being balls, but they would have left it on the table as an option, that physical corporal punishment was an option. And I think it would be fair to say that we didn't have a relationship-based model of growing. It was, they told me what to do. I either did it or I didn't. And punishment was a factor. So the punishment might have been as innocuous as, you know, you can't go out this afternoon. Or it might have been more severe. But anyway, the idea is that the way you controlled your children was largely a punishment, a negative model. Don't do this, don't do that. There wasn't a lot of catch the child doing right. We didn't think that way. Now, as I raise my kids, for many, many reasons, so many things happen. But in the parenting world, there's a huge shift over to the idea of what is the child's point of view? How can we catch the child being right? And again, dog training follows that. So that direction has had a huge influence as well on how we raise dogs. And I have to say, if you only gave me one tool to talk to a pet person, I will always go for analogies every single time. Well, why doesn't your four-month-old puppy come when it's called? The same reason your toddler doesn't come when you're at the park and you want to leave. It's the same. Why do you hold your toddler's hand when you walk on a busy street? Because it's dangerous. Why do you put your dog on a leash? Because it's not safe. You may or may not work your way towards, let's say, off-leash control or a reliable recall. That's based on a million different things. But your expectation of a toddler and your expectation of a puppy, I have had incredibly good luck developing sympathy from people who started out very frustrated with their animal, just with 10 minutes of conversation, not even 5 minutes of conversation, talking about how we raise children and having a lot of sympathy. I remember how frustrated I was when my child was three and everything was a struggle and I couldn't have a peaceful meal. And I tell them that story when they've just told me about how frustrating their dog is. I don't even talk about the dog. I just listen to the complaint and I say, oh, I understand. I remember when my kids were that age. And it's up to them to make the connection, unless they're just incredibly dense. They will make the connection. If I only had one tool, that is the one I will go to every single time when working with people, because I don't care what anybody says. Dogs and humans are hugely similar. We have the same basic emotional reactions. And if I look at my dog and think about what I would do with a kid, there's a really good chance I'm going to get it right.
Yeah, I've heard you make this analogy a few times, you know, between dogs and children. And I was wondering, is that something that you've done a lot of research in the parenting side of things with the goal of kind of inspiring your training?
No. I read a lot. I know a lot about a lot of things just by being in the world. I pay attention. I talk to absolutely everyone. And I do mean everyone. Like, I walk down the street and some random person, I'll stop and talk to them too. I gather as much as I can from life experiences. And then my brain naturally makes all the connections and pulls them together. And
when you said modern parenting, that isn't something that you've read into or anything like that. It's more from talking to people and.
No, I do read too. But not research reading. It's generic reading, you know, and because I encourage those kind of conversations, people will say, oh, are you familiar with fill in the name? I'm not. And I'll spend 20 minutes. I'll just check out, you know, what does that person say? And I grab those connections and I also spend a lot of time and energy thinking about human training. I actually spend more time thinking about human training than dog training these days. And so, for example, how can we change human behavior? It's a huge interest of mine. So a lot of my reading is about that. And guess what? In the process of talking about learning about changing human behavior and how humans behave, you are going to encounter child rearing, learning, education. And I do have children. So they're older now. They're 18 and 15. And God, is it painful. But anyway, you can't help but make those connections if you choose to pay attention. And I do choose to pay attention. And so I'm quick and free with those analogies, which drives some people up the wall. But you know what? It works. And I am a results-oriented person. So if it improves the situation, then I'm going to do it.
It's really cool that you do focus so much on the people as well, because I was having this conversation with someone else recently where it seems like a better predictor of being a great pet dog trainer is actually more about being a great coach of people than it is being a great dog trainer. You know, like there's a lot of people that are kind of like mediocre dog trainers that are great pet dog trainers.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, like, cause they know how to get the person doing the right thing in order to change the dog's behavior. Right. Like, and how to make them feel inspired.
Yeah. I think the very cool thing is if you're a great dog trainer, you have the capacity, if you choose to be a great human trainer, because it's identical. So you focus on what the person's doing right. It's exactly the same. Admittedly, you might have to look a while to find something right. So if I have to walk in somebody's house, and I'm making this up, but anyway, if I walk in somebody's house and there's poop all over the place because the dog's not housebroken and it's been shredded up and down, I can look at the dog and say, oh my God, I love the way he wags his tail. Okay, right? You have to look, you find it, and then you need to learn to believe it. You need to believe that people are doing their best. I absolutely believe this. I believe we are, just like dogs who are aggressive, problematic, fearful. I believe it's a combination of genetics and environment and training. And I believe that about people. Who you are today, whether you are, in my opinion, an attractive person or an unattractive person, is genetics, environment, and all of your training. So it doesn't matter if it's a dog or a person. I need to give the benefit of the doubt to the human being I'm talking to. And when I'm able to step back and say, this person who is behaving in ways I don't like, they are doing the best they can for who they are right now, just like a dog. When I'm looking at a really problematic dog, I don't say, I don't like this dog. I say, wow, there's a lot going on here. This dog got a bad roll of the dice. It could have been genetically bad. It could have been environment. It doesn't matter. It makes me kind to that dog. And when I look at an owner who's doing everything wrong, they did not set out to choose to do everything wrong. Nobody does that. Everybody does their best. But you say, oh, but how can you say it's the best when they're correcting the dog? Because of their genetics, their environment, and their training. It is what they know. Or maybe it's how they feel good about themselves. I mean, the reality is even really sick people who do really horrible things, maybe they don't have a better capacity. Genetics, environment, or training. Doesn't matter. It is who they are today. I'm not interested in personally feeling good about the situation. I'm interested in changing behavior. That means I look at the human being just like a dog. I often say, do you want to feel right or do you want to change behavior? So for example, I'm walking down the street. I see somebody with an off-leash dog. What are my options? I could scream, don't you know this is an on-leash area? Now let's all think about that. Has that ever changed anyone's behavior ever in the history of walking your dog? Ever? Like, no. So you walk your dog down the street, you see an off-leash dog. What are your choices? How might you change behavior? I can tell you I never have problems. Here's what I would do. In the case like that, first, I just go for the fearful expression. That often goes far because my dog is with me, right? I'm kind of panicking. People do see that. Second option, yell out, say, you know, my dog is very old and fragile, and I'm afraid if your dog comes over here, she's going to be afraid. It's going to scare her because she doesn't want to get hurt. If they can catch their dog, which is, as we all know, kind of dicey, but anyway, if they can catch their dog, when you say that, when you reach out and create a bridge, they will change their behavior. What if they can't? Well, hopefully your dog has some training. I abandon my dog for a moment. I catch their dog gently, gently by the collar. I wait. And then I apologize. When they get to me, I say, I'm sorry, I had to catch your dog. My dog is old and scared. And if your dog jumped on her, I'm afraid it would hurt her. Now, guess what happens the next time I see that person on the street? Without exception, they will leash their dog. They will smile at me. We will have a pleasant interaction. Now, did I change behavior? Yes, I did. Did I get to feel right? Did I get to yell about, you asshole, walking your dog off leash? Oh my God, I lost it. I lost all that opportunity to be angry and self-righteous. And I changed behavior. That is how I think about humans. I'm not interested in being right. Well, that's not true. I'm very interested in being right, but I'm more interested in changing behavior than I am in being right. And as a result, I go through the world 98% of the time having a good day because I don't see the world as out to get me and all stupid because they don't know how to train their dogs. Well, they may not know how to train their dogs, but for all I know, they have a Nobel Prize in physics. So what? Am I stupid because I can't figure out why the bowling ball falls when I drop it? No, I'm different.
Well, I didn't realize how much energy you have, Denise. You just, oh. you're on it.
When you share. Just didn't present.
You know, one of the biggest things I found helpful is recognizing it's the anger emotion. You know, when like trying to recognize when you start to feel angry. You know, so like if it was the off-leash dog, like seeing the dog off-leash where they shouldn't be, and then starting to feel angry, and then recognizing I'm feeling angry, and then like trying to process that with logic instead of just pure emotion and, you know, doing something I'll end up regretting. One area I want to get into though is, you know, I think the majority, I mean, of course we have dog sports people that listen to this as well, but I think that there's a lot of pet dog trainers, and I'm really curious about maybe you think things that you think maybe the pet dog world is lagging behind on the dog sports world with, because I definitely have one big one, but I'm going to see if you bring it up before I jump in.
The one thing I would say, if you want to be successful in dog sports, you're going to have to know some things, right? So you're going to have some skills. You're going to have to make those skills hold up under pressure. You're going to have to make those skills hold up in a novel environment. You're going to have to make those whole skill, those skills hold up when you're scared. Cause I guarantee you, for the 3 days before the dog event, you wake up sick and you don't even know why until you think about it. You have to be able to get rid of that constant flow of food. You can't wear your bait bag and feed your dog every 7 seconds. If you look at all of these things, the elements of excellent training are all tested in a competition. So whether you like it or not, you are going to learn what happens if you don't generalize your dog's behavior. You might learn the hard way. I mean, many of us went to our first show quite certain we would win the whole damn thing because our dog in the backyard was so amazing. But when you go out into the dog show, your skills are going to be tested in a way that, in my opinion, is absolutely impossible if you don't do it. So with dogs I don't compete with, I can talk about what I think they might be able to do, but I would never say what they can do because I don't know. When I get to the show, I'm going to find out that maybe my skills were not as good as I thought. Maybe they were not as solid in this new environment, you know? So what I think people can get out of preparing for dog sports and actually following through is a little humility and a little recognition of just how hard it is. And it is hard, especially if you're really striving for the upper levels. But no matter, I have so much respect for a person who goes out there and does it. I don't care if it's the most basic level. You did it. You got out there and your skills were better for it, especially if you go home and say, okay, that was a disaster. Now, how can I make that better? So what I think dog sports do is force good training because you cannot be successful if you don't get there. Now, having said that, I've seen some pretty horrific training turn out very successful dogs. But keep in mind, horrific is a moral judgment. If a person used extreme punishment and got there, they obviously did it well. And what I tell people, if you're a crossover trainer and you've used a lot of punishment maybe in your past, I have great news for you. The timing of excellent punishment is identical to the timing of excellent positive reinforcement. The skill of paying attention, which in my opinion is the one I have the most struggles teaching people, you need to pay attention. Catching your dog being wrong is the opposite of catching your dog being right, but it's the same skill. Timing, the skills of a balanced trainer, they're identical. So they might get in the ring in ways I don't like, but I have really good news for them if they ever show any interest in learning what I have to offer. They already have all of the baseline. They just need to switch it. So rather than looking for the mistake and correcting it, let's look for what's correct and feed it. So I have really good luck working with balanced crossover trainers because it's just a matter of teaching them new things.
Yeah, that's really interesting for sure. I mean, for me, there are things that we can take not only from the dog sports world, but oftentimes from, because I think some of the dog sports can be like very heavily balanced training, right? Like in terms of like percentages of what people are using. And I think that there's stuff that can be learned there, which I guess is what I'm trying to get at. Like the big one for me, which has become a huge part of what I do is, you know, when I was started out doing pet dog training, the emphasis was on solving like the problem that you saw, if that makes sense. So for example, someone presents to you with a recall problem and you teach the dog to come back when you say come, or the dog has a lead walking issue and you teach the dog to walk nicely next to you. And what I soon realized, especially with recall, it comes really obvious with recall, is you can teach a dog a really fantastic recall, but if they don't want to hang out with the owner, all that happens is they come back and then they just shoot back off again. And I kind of ended up stumbling across this idea of engagement training, teaching the dog to want to be with the person. And when I actually started getting into that, and I started kind of going like, Christ, no one is talking about this. Like, where can, is anyone doing this? You know, and I started looking it up. The only people that were talking about it were dog sports people. Like, really, that was all I could find. And actually, you were one of the only people I could find that had put an emphasis on the idea of engagement.
Yeah, I think the reality is if you know you're going to be in the ring for 10 minutes, you don't have any food. And unless your dog is dumb as a stump, they know it. So eventually, if you want your dog to want to be with you and be a willing participant, you're going to have to find some personality and express that to your dog. So I'm actually a big fan of telling people, I'm not interested in teaching the fastest. I don't care if my way takes longer, because I'm not, I spend plenty of time between repetitions chatting with my dog and scratching and interacting. And there's lots of reasons for that. One is I just think it's more fun to train that way. But the other one is, if I want the behavior to hold up in competition, if you think you can walk in the ring and for the first time you're going to praise your dog and think your dog's going to like it, let me tell you what's actually going to happen. If you're always quiet with your training and you use a lot of food, and then you go in the ring and you suddenly realize you have no food, so you're going to start using praise, you're actually going to create a condition to punish her, because the dog will learn that the only time they get praised is when you got nothing better to offer. Well, that is not a connection you really want your dog to make. And so for me, winding a personal interaction and personality into my relationship with my dog, I think dogs have been bred for hundreds of years to value our approval, our attention, who we are. I know people will absolutely argue with me. They'll say that this is all conditioned. Sorry, I don't agree. I've raised puppies, and I have watched 19-day-old puppies look up at me in their little blue milky eyes and wag their tails and come to visit me, and I have never fed them a thing. I simply don't believe that a dog is nothing but a conditioned box that says, oh, humans carry food. Why do my dogs like my family? I guarantee you that my family doesn't do any food training. They like my family because dogs are wired to like people. But if you're not careful, you can actually lose that. Because I can't count for you how many people have said to me, I don't understand. I do all the training with my dog. I do all the play. I do all the food. And yet my dog prefers my husband. And I said, maybe that's because your husband has a genuine interaction with your dog. Like, plays with your dog on that deeper level, the way we interact with people. My husband doesn't like me, I hope, because we dinner together. I hope he likes me because we spend time together. And so when I look at a dog, I see it as so much more than building up relationships through food. I see it as spending a lot of time with your dog, genuine approval and warmth and interaction. I am happy to see you, and I'm going to make sure you know I feel that way. All of my training includes that. I'm really happy to be here with you. Do you want to be here with me? And if you don't, then you are free to leave. Now, that was a mistake if you leave, because really, I'm a pretty interesting person. So if you hang out with me, it's going to be worth your while. And all my dogs know that. Time with me is important and special, and not because of the food and toys. It's because of the package. And that package includes the fact that I'm a decent person who loves you, and I scratch your head, and I tell you how amazing you are, and I tend to let the details, the little mistakes, go. I don't say too much. As a matter of fact, do you know how I handle errors? I praise my dog. So I say, good girl, you try so hard. Let's do it again. It's exactly the same way you would work with a child. Exactly the same. You're working on your multiplication tables. That's a misery, right? 5 minutes of drills. 3 times 3, 9. Yes, you did it. 3 times 3, 8. Oh, so close. There's not that much of a difference. So for me, the way you develop engagement with your dog is, put your food away for a second. Put your toys away for a second. Spend some time with your dog. If I ask you, how does your dog like to be petted? Does he like to be scratched? Does he like to be patted? Does he like to be rough? You should be able to answer that question. It's your dog. Just like if I say, what food does your dog like? Oh, he likes cheese and he likes steak. But you can't tell me how your dog likes to play. So to me, that's a fundamental error. If a trainer does not explore that area, your dog should know these things.
Well, play is a really beautiful way of getting a dog engaged as well, because you have a real interactive element, which is harder to replicate with food, especially in the way, and actually this comes to another thing I see dog sports people doing and less pet dog people doing. Like, a lot of pet dog trainers, the only way we give dogs food is posting it in their mouth. And it's like, oh, you know, there's so much more you can do with food. Like, I know that you call it pocket hand, right? Like, where you put the, I don't know if we're thinking of the same thing, but where you put the treat, like, yeah, under your thumb, between your thumb and your palm. And you can, like, make food a game of chase. And that's just one thing you can do with food. And that's another, that I didn't even intend to go there, but there's another, like, thing that I see dog sports people doing and putting an emphasis on, and maybe this all comes back to this idea of engagement, you know, having a dog that does want to be with you. And for me, Denise, I don't know if this is what you're getting at as well, but sometimes I feel like with engagement, there are identifiable behaviors that we can choose to reinforce, right? Like, you know, so like the classic when I meet up with a pet dog owner is they go for a walk, the dog does not look at them at all for their entire walk, right? And it's like, well, why don't we start rewarding him every time he does look at you? Because that would be a really nice start, right? To getting some engagement with a dog.
You know, one thing I've noticed, if for whatever reason, I am not spending a lot of time with a given dog over a period of time, and then let's say I take that dog out to go hiking, I have noticed a huge difference in how much the dog looks to me without any cue or just based on how much time I have been spending with that dog in general. So if I, my old dog, let's say I train her every day and then I take her for a hike, she will check with me constantly, not because I'm reinforcing her, but because we're friends. Let's say for that week before I hadn't trained her at all and I take her for a hike, the amount of time she will spend checking in with me will be much less because she is now wired towards the environment and doing her own thing for her entertainment. And I am lower on the radar. I often talk about being on my dog's radar. I don't need to be high on the radar. I do in a formal training session, but in life, my dog should always know where I am in the house. They just should. And you know what? I know where every dog in my house is too. It's a sense because I pay attention and they pay attention. And you can build that or lower that just by paying attention to how much you pay attention to what your dog is doing and just spending some time to interact. You know, I actually think it's such a loss when pet people in particular don't value what is so amazing about a dog, which is that it's a dog. It's another species living in your house. And how you can't smile and pat the head when you walk by, I don't understand. So I strongly encourage informal engagement. There are few things that make me happier than driving down the street and looking off to the side and seeing usually a man in the middle of a park running with his dog, running and playing and chasing. I will pull the car over and just watch it like a total stalker. It makes me happy. It's so free and light. And to me, it's what a dog and a person are.
You know, that's funny that you say that, Denise, because there is something really beautiful about seeing a dog that, you know, is looking up at their owner and wanting to play with them, wanting to engage with them. Like that really, for me, it was a bit of an epiphany when I came to this idea of engagement and that became a big part of my stuff because what it made me realize was this is actually kind of what I wanted in the beginning. And I just didn't realize, you know, like this dog that wanted to be with me and was more interested in hanging out with me and doing cool stuff with me than everything else in the park.
Yeah. And there's, you can hugely stack the deck in your favor on this one too. So working bred dogs, so whether a working line lab or golden or Malinois or shepherd or whatever, working line dogs are bred to have a lot of that engagement in them. So it's not that unusual for them to naturally start. You don't have to work that hard to get some breeds of dogs to want to engage with you. And you will work very hard to get other breeds of dogs that have been bred, let's say terriers. So a dog that's been bred for generations to go to ground, some of the small terriers, it's not that you can't get engagement. I have one of those dogs, but I have to work way harder, like 10 times, 20 times harder because his innate interest is so environmental. Now, the thing about him, the entertainment value is so high on this dog. You can go out and sit and just watch him for half an hour. And he's adorable. You know, he's into everything and he's got to check everything. And he's not afraid of very much. You know, he goes into tiny little holes and I'm like, God, that makes me claustrophobic just to watch you. Watching a dog be who they are is fascinating, but it's a trade-off. So when I compare that to my Belgians, and my Belgians are wired for connection, they are wired to want to do things with me. And I can value and appreciate both. They are very different. It does bother me a lot when people say, well, if you would just work harder, your dog would stare at you. And I'm like, whoa, 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 let's back that up. Are you saying dogs don't bring anything to the table? Really? Then why are there so many border collies in obedience competition? We should see just as many of any breed if they're all the same. Dogs come with a huge capacity. And things like these 15-minute competitions, it's not just agility. I mean, really, look at a greyhound. Do you think a greyhound couldn't do working dog trials? Really? Should be fast, should be able to spring over anything, should have the endurance. They're bred for this. And yet, when was the last time you saw a greyhound competing in working dog trials? It's not physical capacity. It's all of the picture that goes in there. And so I really enjoy with my working bred dogs how easily they come to the table with me, how pleasurable it is to be personally, to be with a dog. Like the last time I took my old dog to the vet, she says, does she ever not look at you? And this is a half hour later after they've done things to my dog. And I said, well, actually, no, that's what she does. She's bred to stare at me. And I have refined that. My terrier, not so much. I mean, I can ask him to interact with me and he does so willingly because we have a relationship, but it's not where his mind goes. It's not the first thing he does.
And Denise, you know, as you're saying this, I can just kind of imagine some people saying, well, your dog shouldn't be staring at you all the time. They should be experiencing life. And, you know, if they're staring at you all the time, then they're going to damage their necks or, you know, it's going to affect their musculature or whatever.
Yeah, I don't know. If I'm sitting in a chair, they're just looking. And the old dog, speaking of which, so she's 15. And what's interesting is, so I walk her every day, no matter what. That's her time. And now on her walk, she doesn't look at me at all. As a matter of fact, this is great. I have to use food to keep her with me. Isn't that interesting? My champion everything obedience dog, plus everything else she did. The dog has done everything. The reason is our relationship has been eroded by the lack of training and by my choice to let her do anything she wants whenever she wants. She truly runs the show. That's a choice, but it has eroded our relationship. So she walks around sniffing trees and all. Now I don't sniff trees with her. I suppose I could, but I don't. That is how she chooses to spend her time. In the old days when she was young, everything was about me and what I wanted. And she was most willing to come along. But I mean, now she's deaf, so she also doesn't come because she can't hear me. But the fact is, 3 years ago, when I started just letting her do anything she wanted, I found it much harder to get natural obedience from her. I just mean naturally working with me. She stopped checking in because I stopped training her. So was she unhappy? Well, no. Every day she got her nice hour-long outing. And of course, in the house, I interact with her. But I stopped concentrating on her because she was no longer competing. So it's, I don't know that it's good or bad. It's different ways to go through life, right? It's different things we choose. Is she happier now or less happy? Well, she's old, but if she wasn't old, I would say she's less happy now. I would say she thrived on that quality time. I remember I took her to France to breed her, and it was miserably cold and it was snowing and it was tough. And I remember every day, because I would exercise her, I would take her out, I would play ball, but I would play ball for free. I didn't ask for anything because it was cold and I just wanted to be done with it. And one day we ended up at an IPO field when we were there and somebody said, feel free to work your dog. And, you know, okay, I did. And the change in her demeanor was shocking. Like she was just like, this is way cooler than playing ball. This is what we do. This is how we interact. This is, and it was so interesting. She could have the reinforcer for free. I'd been playing ball. She didn't want that. She wanted to do things with me and work for her reinforcers, which was, you know, kind of eye-opening and interesting. So is it not healthy for a dog to stare at you? I don't know. I mean, she really likes me. Spend a lot of time looking at her. Now, that's a little different than healing. She doesn't sit at my side staring up. She's watching me right now. She's under my desk. She's laying down, having a rest. She looks very comfy. But if I look down, I see her eyes flick up. She just wants to know we're here. If I walk out of this room, she'll follow me, which makes me feel terrible. My God, she's old. She should rest. No. So at the vet, it's a little bit of an uncomfortable situation. She trusts me 100%. There's no food in that situation. She can't eat because who knows what they'll do to her. But it doesn't matter. She's like, as long as you stay with me, it's okay. And when they say, can I take your dog away? I say, you know, for this dog, if you let me stay here with her all the time, I can guarantee you, you will have no troubles with her. If you take her away from me, she will be scared. And she's old. And I don't want my old dog to be scared. And the vet thinks about that and says, you can stay with your dog. Then they see what happens when I stay with my dog. And in their future, they're like, come on back, come on back. Because it works for them. It works for me. She is muzzle trained. When she was younger, I would say, I would like to put a muzzle on her. And they'd say, but you don't need to. She's not a problem. I said, that's not why I want to muzzle her. I want to muzzle her so that she understands biting is off the table. And the only thing she has left is to rely on me. And as soon as I put a muzzle on her and I say everything is fine, she relaxes because she's like, all right, so I'm not going to be biting anyone. No, you're not going to be biting anyone. Not that she runs around biting people, but why have that conversation? And I'm right here with you. And then the vet's like, wow, that really worked. I thought we might have some issues here. I'm like, no, we just have to set up a little situation that works for everybody.
Uh-huh. That's interesting as an idea. Like, you think that the dog understands the concept of the muzzle in that situation then. Do you feel like your dog is shutting down or is, you know...
Interesting question. There's no doubt that a dog understands a muzzle, that they know that biting is no longer an option. I'm actually thinking about a specific...
But dogs do attempt to bite in the muzzle often.
No, that's a dog who's just over the top, not a dog who's thinking about it. There's a difference between thinking and reacting. So if you put a muzzle on a dog who's thinking and you put the muzzle on, they may act up because it still gets what they want. If the dog is trying to get the other away, then a good display might do that. But if my dog is in the room and thinking about biting somebody because they actually want to bite them to stop it, you put a muzzle on and they go, all right, that option's off the table. They could still display. My dog would not. I learned this, kind of couldn't have missed it, when I did her x-rays for her hips and elbows to make sure she was good. And she was very young and very lively. And I took her into the vet's office. She's all over the place. She's not going to bite anyone, but she's all over the place. And I can see the vet going, I don't think we're going to be able to do this without sedation. And I do not want to sedate my dog. So I said, no, she'll be fine. Let me just muzzle her. Put the muzzle on. And she goes, all righty. That's the end of it. Now, did it shut her down? That is a great question. I would say yes, that in the sense that she recognized that that choice was no longer a choice, then her best next choice is to ask me what I think is the best answer.
It kind of sounds a little bit like learned helplessness, right? Like, I know I can't do anything, so I'm just going to stand here.
Yeah, but I would. The problem I have with that is the negative implication. The other side of learned helplessness is if you learn that if you always look to the researcher, you'll have no troubles, then that's not learned helplessness. What you've learned is to opt for another person to save you. The problem with learned helplessness is there's no way out. What I'm telling my dog is, well, taking it into your own hands, that is not an option. That is not going to work. Looking to me will always work because I will never put you in a situation where you are harmed. And I think I can say consistently with my dogs, never put them in situations. I will step up every time. Even if that means I'm going to get bitten by another dog, I will never put you in a situation. So once I was walking the old dog, this was about a year ago, and there was this dog. Her name is Sassy. I know the dog. I've tried to work with the situation. It's off leash. It comes out the gate, and it always stops at the same place. So we know the drill, right? And on this day, Sassy didn't stop. She's coming at me. Like, I'm like, what the hell happened to Sassy? She's just straight at me. And I just told my dog, you just stay. And I dealt with Sassy. Now, I did figure out why that happened. But anyway, my dog, I didn't even turn around to see what she was doing. I knew that she knew I would take care of the matter. And I got Sassy back home. The reason Sassy did that, by the way, here's just an interesting dog thing. The owner was outside. I've never seen the owner outside before. The presence of the owner gave Sassy the courage to come forward and actually try to get me. Whereas in the past, Sassy's just outside by herself being an idiot and she has no intention of engaging. But with the owner behind her back, she's like, all right, I'll take this on. So my dog, though, she's just like, she doesn't want to have a fight, but she also knows I'm going to take care of things. I'm always taking care of things for her. And so she just relies on me.
I think that's something that a lot of people struggle with as well. It's one of those questions I get a lot where, especially if someone has a fearful dog or a dog that is reactive, you know, how do you deal with that situation where someone's just let their dog just run up to you? And sometimes it can be really hard, especially, you know, because you're trying to help your dog and then someone else's dog is just barreling towards you and just making the situation so much worse.
It sucks. But, you know, the way I handle that besides, I talk a lot about leadership. I know that's not a very popular word because people, they substitute the word dominance when I say leadership, but no, I really do mean leadership. I mean it in the same sense of a boss who's a good leader or a teacher who's a good leader. To me, leadership is about stepping up and solving problems. And so the kinds of things when I'm working with a reactive dog. So for example, if I don't want your off-leash dog to bother my on-leash dog, then I'm probably going to walk my dog on a busy street. Because guess what? People don't walk dogs off-leash that are out of control on a busy street. So making decisions, looking at the bigger picture is, in my opinion, this is what I call paying attention. And when I said it's the hardest thing to teach, it is unbelievably hard to get people to pay attention. You need to know where all the people and all the dogs are when you're taking a dog out who's on the fragile side. And you need to be aware that if you go certain places, you're taking a risk, which doesn't mean you shouldn't do it, but you just need to be aware that you're taking a risk about where you're going and what you're doing and how you're going to manage situations. And I don't let my reactive dogs make a lot of decisions. I tell them exactly what they're going to do right now because they don't make good decisions. So my terrier who had issues, I decided to fix it. I actually kind of did. It took me about 4 or 5 months. I just had to make a decision that we're going to deal with this. And whenever I saw him showing certain behaviors, I'm like, no, this is actually the behavior you're going to do right now. And it does not involve food because eating is not the solution. It involves behavior. You're not going to stare. The reason you're not going to stare is because the next thing you do after you stare is act like a fool. And we're not going to do that. Here's what you're going to do. You're going to walk in a circle. Okay, great. We're going to move on. Oh, no, I'm looking at your body language. When your tail goes like that, guess what happens next? You start to stare. And what happens after that? That's all bad. So what am I going to do? You are going to do this thing for me. Excellent. And if you do these things for me, I will give you what you want. You want to get closer to that dog? Then I'll let you get closer to that dog. Fear is way harder. If a dog is fearful, though, then the question I ask is, why are you in a situation where you're making your dog feel fearful? Why is your dog there? So someone asked,
oftentimes people are getting surprised though, aren't they? You know, they're trying to avoid everyone and someone comes out of nowhere and
crap happens. You know, you cannot train for the bizarre. So if you're in, you know what? You go out in your backyard, some strange dog is there. Is it common? Well, no, but could it happen? Absolutely. Yeah. Don't train for the bizarre. Don't even spend your energy on the bizarre, but ask yourself this question. If the bizarre is a daily event, is it bizarre? So the number of people who say to me, my dog has been attacked repeatedly. Do accidents happen? Yes, once, twice. How many attacks are we talking here? Over what period of time? Have you considered maybe not walking your dog there? It's not working for you. So part of taking responsibility, if you have a child who's fearful, then you don't take them places that are inclined to bring up fear and then be surprised when things go badly. So it's a two-way street here. Mm-hmm. I do a lot of training. I do a lot of prepping the dog for how, like, management. If I end up in a bad situation, I just need to get out of there. I'm not worried about the training. I just need to get out. I don't care what that looks like. Pick up my dog, drag it away on the leash, use a cookie. I don't care. I just need to get out. Go home and reflect. All right. How did I get myself in that situation? Is there anything I could have done? Could I have seen this coming? Those are the kind of questions I'm going to ask. And then maybe I just had a bad day. You know, that day Sassy came out the fence. I didn't see that coming. I just dealt with it. That's separate from training, which is setting things up ideally before you have a problem. And a lot of the times, if I could just get through to people, have a plan. When you get caught by surprise and you just truly don't know what to do, I can tell you, your dog looked at you and read that so fast and said, wonderful. Nobody knows what to do, right? That is what I mean by lack of leadership. When your dog looks at you and you're paralyzed, that's not a winner, right? Mm-hmm. That alone is going to drive your dog to make bad decisions because somebody's got to run the show.
To change the subject quite wildly, Denise, only because I'm conscious of time. What are your opinions of how do you feel about how, or, you know, pet dog trainers' use of toys? Do you feel like there's a difference between how sports dog trainers are, you know, approaching play with toys and pet dog trainers?
Yeah. So pet dog trainers tend to use toys as a relationship builder and competition people tend to use them as a reinforcer. I do both. But anyway, so to be more clear, as a reinforcer, it's if you do this, then I do that,
right? You sat fast, I give you the toy. So what we're doing is trying to build drive, the energy that a dog brings with the toy, we're trying to bring that to the work. Most pet dog trainers use it sort of at the end, kind of at the end. We're just playing. We're having a good time. Let's create a positive response to the training environment and to me. I'm not saying it's right or wrong. It's just a bit different. Most pet dog trainers don't think in terms of precision, like I need you to sit really fast so that I can reinforce it. I don't think they think that way. As a matter of fact, I'm not even sure they would find that desirable. It would freak me out if my pet dog hit the ground. I mean, it would just be weird. It's like, if I say down, I just want you to relax, not smack yourself into the ground. So it's a different, it's a different interest. And actually just even healing. I don't like my dogs to look at me when we go for a walk, like healing. It freaks me out. It's like, get on being a dog. That's not the time for you to stare at me. Checking in is wonderful, but don't walk at my side doing that weird thing. That's training. So I think we use them differently in that sense. But no matter what, I really do like toys and training. I don't care how you use it. I don't care if it's to make a relationship or just to have fun. And I love watching people play with their dogs with toys and being silly because it brings out the silly. And I like that. So I do see a difference, though, yes.
When I've looked into toy play, and again, you know, a lot of the resources seem to be based on, you know, in that come from that sports world, it seems like there is... It seems way more thought out, you know, like the details of, you know, it's just everything, you know, the way that you use a toy is so much more thorough in dog sports, yeah, as opposed to pet dog stuff, which is often just much, you know, it's much more just give the dog the toy. Or,
yeah. No, we have rules. Dog trainers have a lot of rules, and I have probably more rules than anyone, because I know how particular it can be. We inadvertently create a lot of pressure around toys. You know, we stare at our dogs, we try to stuff the toys in their faces. We do all these things that don't do us favors. So I would say a high percentage of dogs do really enjoy toys and toy play, but it is a mechanical skill. So you do have to learn how to play in a way that is safe for you, safe for the dog, and actually engaging. And it is a learned skill. And I think most people don't have it without some very concrete and specific training. It's actually a personal passion, is teaching people to play with toys, teaching people personal play, because you can so quickly change their the response they get from the dog. It's like, oh, you get me. So I find that really helpful. Also, just from safety, I get stressed when I watch people bend over when they play with toys because they're going to get hurt. So I really like to see good body mechanics and good skills there.
Do you think that the only way to learn those skills is by working with someone that can coach you through that process? Or is there something that people listening to this podcast can start to pick up?
So if your bottom line is the dog's response, you can train yourself. So do something and how does the dog respond? So if you're excellent at reading dog behavior, your dog will always tell you. So you do something, you face your dog flattens just even a tiny bit. What does that tell you? That what you just did was wrong. So you can let the dog train you the same way you train a dog, which is how many of us learned. It's going to be a slower process, and you're videotaping. I'm a huge fan of videotaping. So go ahead and videotape. Run with it. Give it a shot. See what you get, right? And if the dog says, no, like the first time I remember trying personal play with one of my dogs and she literally ran off because I scared her. I was trying to be playful and silly and she's like, no, you're going to eat me. And that was that. But I learned from the experience. I learned a little stalking is okay. A lot is maybe not so good. Everything is easier if you get somebody to train you. But make do with what you've got. And the free resources out there, there's millions of them.
Well, you video your own training stuff, right?
I do.
For Instagram and your social?
Yeah. So on Instagram, I just started an Instagram account a few months ago. It's at Reika's Mom, R-A-I-K-A-S-M-O-M is my thing. And I like providing free training. I like giving people ideas. So what I do is take one of my dogs outside and I try to, because Instagram is 1 minute, right? So I try within 1 minute to show some tiny things. So today's is going to be how to use a chin rest to hold the dog's front feet still when you give position changes like sit and stand, so you don't have to use an object like a pivot. And then I will add a hold of an object, and then I will put those together so I can show people how holding the object and cueing a sit prevents the front feet from moving, and then I will add that to a retrieve. So I like to use video to give people snippets. I am a kind of a big fan of free. I like to give things away. Here's a tip for those of you out here going, no, I can't do things for free. I will make no money. It is the reverse. This is my business tip for the day. Give it away. Give the information away. You are going to improve the well-being of dogs. You are going to improve the lives of people and dogs. And this is the important part. If you have the money to pay for it, people would rather pay for information that has been organized and curated for you than create it from free resources. So give it away so people who can't afford it can have it. And then people who have the money will pay you to do the hard lifting. So there's my free advice.
I completely agree. And, you know, I remember listening to the Dunbar's podcast, and I think Ian was talking about how when he started giving his books away, he got more sales.
We live in a world where controlling information is foolish because everybody else is giving it away. So why don't you put something out there that's good and accurate and make sure people can find it? Plus, you're going to feel good about yourself. You know, I get emails, a lot of emails from people saying, you put out this series of free things and it literally changed how I train my dog. Well, so think about that. You just improve somebody's life. You improve the life of their dog. So give it away. If you've got it, people will come back. You'll make your money. Don't worry about it. But be on the generous side and it will serve you well.
Yeah. Well, talking of social media, I don't know if you're aware of this, Denise, but Reddit loves you. You are like the most popular dog trainer on Reddit.
Yeah, that's bizarre. I don't really do much with Reddit. I actually have a fake name on Reddit. I'll just tell you.
A fake name?
I do. I like to respond under my fake name. I give out dog training advice. If I'm going to go on Reddit, it's almost certainly not under my real name. I find it really interesting to see how people address non-people. Does that mean something? Yeah. Because when I say something, it carries too much weight. So I like to do it under my other name, which I'm of course not going to tell you, because I like to see how people handle me. But me as Denise, I almost never do anything on Reddit. I prefer to do it anonymously, which is fascinating. Like
it is
interesting. I can say things as my other person and get a really appalling response. I can say the same thing as myself and, oh, that's wonderful. I should have thought of that, you know? So it's very interesting.
I think a lot
of
people.
It's the only place I use a fake name. I would like to have one on Facebook, but I don't. So, you know.
Okay. I think a lot of people use fake names on Reddit, actually.
I think so, too.
Yeah. But to kind of wrap this up, where else can people find out more about you? Obviously, Instagram is your big one right now for, you know, free content.
For free content, go to Instagram. You can train a dog off my blog, denisefenzi.com. I've been writing there for 8 years. Plus, that's where if I get all up in arms and upset because somebody said something, you'll know it because you'll see a post come out in the next 3 days. And generally, if I run off on a tangent, something struck me. I don't know how people survive without a blog. How do you express your anger, your frustration if you don't have a blog? Everybody go out and get a blog. It's very important. I do my school, Fenzi Dog Sports Academy. We run 40 classes a term. We run 10 webinars a month. We have the Pet Professionals Program for pet dog trainers, 1-hour workshops, and they're really quite cheap. I made them as cheap as I could. There's tons of ways you can get me. Follow me on Facebook. Follow me on Instagram.
You even have a podcast, right? The Fenzi Dog Sports Academy
Fenzi
podcast.
Fenzi Dog Sports Academy podcast comes out once a week. Yeah, and we interview both inside the school and outside the school. YouTube. I do have Denise Fenzi on YouTube. But I haven't done as much lately there. There's so many opportunities, so many people to keep an eye on.
Well, thanks so much for coming on and, you know, sharing your thoughts with us.
I'm so glad you had me. This was fun. I appreciate it.
Hey, before you go, don't forget to check out the show notes on nickbenger.com/Denise-Fenzi. That's just where I throw up all the links so you don't have to go Googling all over the place to find it. And also, don't forget to follow our pain and suffering over on the Get In Shape-Temba Facebook group. All right, see ya.